This episode features discussions of kidnapping, rape, extreme sexual sadism, and violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
January 1978. 21-year-old Colleen Stan shuddered as her coffin-like box opened. The man reached in and pulled her out by the chain around her neck. She blinked. Her eyes were unaccustomed to the light. How long had she been held here? 6 months? A year?
Still bound and gagged, Colleen stumbled to her feet. Her kidnapper put a document in front of her. A slavery contract. He ordered her to sign it. A representative from the company was upstairs, waiting for the contract.
The man had warned her time and again, if she tried to escape, a group of slavers known as the company would hunt her down and torture her to death.
Colleen felt faint. The room began to spin as a wave of helplessness washed over her. She knew she had but one option. The thought of it made her sick. Slowly, feebly, she signed the paper. The man smiled and told her to call him Master.
Colleen had been kidnapped while hitchhiking in 1977. She was held captive by a sexual sadist for the next 7 years, during which time she was brainwashed into believing she was legally his slave. This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can listen to all of Parcast's shows on Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts. New episodes of Hostage come out every Thursday.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. Well, you allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This is our first episode on the kidnapping of Colleen Stan, a 20-year-old woman who spent 7 years held hostage as a sex slave to husband and wife duo Cameron and Janice Hooker in Red Bluff, California.
On May 19th, 1977, Colleen Stan was hitchhiking from her home in Eugene, Oregon, when she accepted a ride from a harmless-looking couple with an infant girl.
Suddenly, the man jumped her and took her to his home, where he made her live in a small box under the bed for the next 7 years.
This week, we'll look at Colleen's abduction and the psychological coercion Cameron Hooker used to brainwash Colleen into believing that an all-powerful group of slavers was watching her every move.
Next week, we'll examine the circumstances that kept Colleen enslaved and the unusual end to Colleen's story. Before we begin, we'd like to extend an added warning. The crimes the Hookers committed against Colleen Stan are much more graphic and disturbing than the typical hostage situations we cover on the show. Please, listen at your own discretion.
The Hookers, residing at 1140 Oak Street in Red Bluff, California, were seen as a polite, hardworking couple. Cameron Hooker was 23 years old and worked diligently at the local lumberyard. His 19-year-old wife, Janice, was plain and slim with a messy mop of brown hair. She kept to herself and took care of the couple's baby girl, Charity.
But the Hooker house was filled with dark secrets. Cameron was obsessed with bondage and had been since he was 5 or 6 years old. He was especially fascinated with sexual domination. It's unclear where he first learned about the practice of sadomasochism, as Cameron was raised in a seemingly normal family.
By high school, Cameron Hooker was tall and ungainly. He was mild-mannered, innocuous, and easily ignored. But he was beginning to harbor dark desires.
By the time he graduated high school in 1972, Cameron's collection of hardcore bondage pornography was massive. Although he didn't read well, he studied the pictures and illustrations depicting various torture techniques.
What he wanted more than anything was a sex partner that would allow him to enact his sadistic fantasies. And in 1973, one such sex partner came along.
Janice was a mousy 15-year-old. The youngest of four daughters, she was easily coerced by her older sisters and deferred to those she viewed as authority figures. But more than that, Janice came from a broken home. Her mother was cold and distant, and her father, a blue-collar worker, was often away on job sites.
They were critical of Janice and told her that she was unintelligent and unattractive. Janice grew up feeling insecure and unworthy of love. So when a mutual friend introduced her to 19-year-old Cameron Hooker, she was quickly smitten.
According to behavioral science expert Peg Streep, when people who grow up in an unloving household find love for the first time, they tend to exhibit an attachment style called anxious preoccupied. This pattern is characterized by constant worry over whether they are truly loved and whether their lover will stay true.
And unfortunately for Janice, this also left her open to manipulation and emotional abuse from a domineering partner. When she met Cameron, she likely thought she had found a strong partner who would take care of her. In reality, she had found a sadist looking for a partner to control. For a predator like Cameron, Janice was the woman of his dreams.
Janice and Cameron began going for long drives, hanging out at burger shacks, and going to see horror movies like The Exorcist. Both were from poor rural families, and neither of them had any interest in education, sports, or culture. But to Janice, Cameron was special. He was over 6 feet tall, and unlike most of the boys in Red Bluff, he had his own car.
Cameron was the first boy who was ever kind to Janice, and she simply adored him. So when Cameron asked to try something new a few months into their relationship, she was only too happy to agree.
But Cameron's little experiment proved far darker than anything she expected.
He took her out to the woods, where he tied her hands with leather cuffs and hung her from a tree. Pain shot through her arms, and Janice begged to be released. Cameron moved closer towards her, but hesitated. He seemed to enjoy watching her yelp in pain.
Instead of letting her down, he explained the concept of bondage to her. Janice could feel the leather cuffs digging into her wrists and cutting off her circulation. She begged to be let down.
Finally, Cameron uncuffed her. She landed on her feet and stumbled back a bit, blood flooding to her arms. She breathed heavy, suddenly aware that the man who had brought her into the woods was a very different person than the man standing before her.
A moment passed between them. Cameron saw the cuff marks on Janice's wrists and could barely contain his excitement. He kissed Janice on the forehead and told her he loved her.
Janice was shell-shocked. He loved her. In her entire life, she had never heard those words. The cuff marks were already fading from her wrist, and really, the whole ordeal hadn't been so bad. It was just the shock of it.
Janice took Cameron's hand. She allowed him to torture her about once a week from that day forward.
On January 18, 1975, Cameron and Janice Hooker were married. Janice was a high school dropout, barely 17, and Cameron had just gotten a job as a woodworker at the local mill. To their wedding guests, everything seemed fine, but in private, Cameron's growing sadistic appetite was starting to trouble Janice.
According to forensic psychiatrist Dr. Park Dietz, sadism is defined not by the wish to inflict pain on others, but by the impulse to have complete mastery over another person. Sadists seek to make others suffer while they are unable to defend themselves, and it's from this complete domination that sadists derive their pleasure. In other words, Cameron liked hurting Janice while she was incapacitated and enjoyed coming up with creative ways to dominate her.
Janice, for her part, was too scared and embarrassed to tell anyone about the abuse. And besides, while his torture sessions were nearly unbearable, Cameron was always so loving afterward.
For the first few years of their marriage, Janice tried to fulfill Cameron's strange requests by being increasingly submissive to his demands. But one afternoon, he finally went too far.
He brought home an army surplus gas mask with the eyes and air holes taped over. He told Janice he wanted her to wear it, and she flat out refused. It was the first time his wife had ever refused one of Cameron's experiments, and he didn't take it well.
He grabbed her and gagged her to muffle her screams as he strapped the mask over her head. She could barely breathe and lashed out wildly for air. Cameron clearly loved every second of it. The encounter left Janice terrified.
Although she was still too afraid to stand up to Cameron, Janice was no longer a willing participant. Then, Cameron brought up a fantasy that might double as Janice's solution. He wanted to bring a girl into the home, a slave who couldn't refuse his most twisted impulses.
Despite his sadistic habits, Janice still loved Cameron, or more likely, she'd grown dependent on him and couldn't imagine living without him.
Initially, she rebuked the idea of another woman in their home, but then she thought of the gas mask. She worried about how Cameron might escalate his impulses next. It might be nice to have someone else take the brunt of the torture.
Janice laid out her terms. She insisted that there would be no sexual intercourse between Cameron and this other woman, and she wanted a child. They shook on it and began making plans to kidnap their very own sex slave.
By 1976, Janice was pregnant with the couple's first child. Janice fixed up a little nursery, while Cameron built out a sex dungeon, each of them making room for a special new someone in their lives.
It was 1977. Spring had sprung in Eugene, Oregon, and 20-year-old Colleen Stan was entering a new phase of her life.
Colleen had grown up in Riverside, California, to divorced, blue-collar parents. As a child, she was warm and friendly, with a passion for writing poetry. As a teenager, however, Colleen started having problems at home. She was molested by her mother's boyfriend, and she later experimented with heroin, contracting hepatitis C from a dirty needle.
In 1973, when Colleen was 16, she dropped out of high school and married a 22-year-old named Tim Stan. The young couple went to live in Ohio near Tim's family. It's unclear why, but their marriage fell on the rocks almost as soon as it started.
In 1974, Colleen terminated an unwanted pregnancy, which seemed to have been the final straw in their marriage. She left her husband and moved back to the West Coast later that year.
She spent the next 3 years bouncing around between jobs and different friends' apartments. But by May 1977, Colleen had found somewhat stable work. She had rented an apartment with some friends in Eugene, Oregon, and finally felt like she was back on her feet.
On May 19th, 1977, Colleen decided that with the weather warm, it was the perfect time to visit her friend in Northern California. She'd be there just in time for her friend's birthday. Her roommates gladly dropped her off on the highway, where she planned to do what she always did, hitchhike down the coast.
She spent the day hitchhiking from Eugene, Oregon to Northern California, where she began thumbing for a ride that would take her the final stretch. Colleen had already turned down two rides, a car full of boys, which made her nervous, and a couple only going a short distance.
So when a blue Dodge Colt stopped on the side of the road, Colleen hoped she would be in luck. the driver seemed friendly enough and close to her own age. His wife sat smiling in the passenger seat, cradling an infant girl. The couple introduced themselves as Alice and Bob and said they were heading toward Mineral, California.
Colleen took note of a strange-looking box sitting on the back seat, but shrugged it off. She was just grateful to find a car going her direction.
A little while later, the car stopped at a gas station, and Colleen excused herself to use the restroom. There, Colleen experienced what she would later describe as a warning from an angel of God. The angel inside Colleen's head said, "Jump out the window, run, and never look back."
But she dismissed the voice as typical anxiety and headed back to the car.
Bob asked if Colleen would be up for seeing some cool nearby ice caves. She wanted to get on her way to see her friend, but figured if it was a short stop, there was no trouble in it. She agreed, and the car drove down a long dirt road.
They drove down into a heavily wooded area, then the car stopped. Colleen watched Alice jump out of the car with the baby. She turned to Bob, but he was gone. The driver's seat was empty.
Suddenly, her car door flew open and Bob jumped inside, a knife at her throat. He ordered her to put her hands above her head. Shocked, Colleen did as he said.
Bob then pulled a pair of handcuffs out of his pocket and bound her. He blindfolded her, gagged her, and tied her ankles. He was very adept at it.
Colleen knew she had been duped. She had no idea who these people really were. She felt something heavy land on her shoulders and realized that the man had slipped the weird box over her head.
The box was Cameron's most cherished invention. Shaped roughly like a hat box, it was deceitfully durable. Made out of strong plywood and weighing roughly 20 pounds, it was insulated with carpet and double-walled to make it sound and light-proof. Nobody would hear Colleen scream, even from the front seat.
Colleen could barely breathe. She felt the car start up and tried not to topple over under the weight of the box. She didn't know where she was going, but if this was the welcoming committee, she could only imagine the horrors to come.
In a moment, Cameron begins to brainwash his new slave.
Now, back to the story.
20-year-old Colleen Stan was terrified. She had set out that morning in May 1977 to hitchhike to a friend's home. Now she was handcuffed and bound, hidden under a blanket in the back seat of a stranger's car, her head shoved into the box. She felt the car jerk as it rumbled over a pothole.
Then, sometime after nightfall, the car stopped. The man, who Colleen would later learn to be Cameron Hooker, snuck Colleen into his small basement under the cover of darkness. He removed the box from her head and stripped Colleen naked, strung her up by her wrists, and began to torture her, leaving her to dangle in agonizing pain.
Afterward, Colleen's head was shoved into the box again.
Colleen was terrified. She couldn't understand who these people were or why they were doing this to her.
She begged God for an opportunity to escape, but while she was trapped in the basement, she at least allowed her mind to wander to her friends and family. She prayed they'd realize she was missing and come looking for her.
Suddenly, Colleen was jolted awake. She had no idea how long she'd been asleep. With her head in the box, darkness swallowed her. Cameron grabbed her and removed the box from her head, then led her to a bedpan, still blindfolded. She felt dizzy, and her throat was drier than sandpaper. Colleen's voice cracked as she asked when she could go home. Cameron replied, "Soon."
He fed Colleen a plate of rotting leftovers and made her drink a glass of water, then put her head back in the box. She would later find out that she had already spent over 24 hours locked in his basement, and it would be another full day before Cameron came to feed her again.
According to Dr. John Leach, a fellow in survival psychology at the University of Portsmouth, during the first 10 days of captivity in extreme isolation, a hostage is likely to exhibit anxiety, introspection, and bursts of restlessness, including thrashing and yelling, and Colleen was no different.
After 2 days in isolation, Colleen grew agitated. She started thrashing, crying, and moaning. She was understandably in hysterics. Suddenly, she heard someone descend the stairs. She assumed it was Cameron, but when the box over her head opened, she saw Janice's face frowning down at her. Janice asked her in earnest what was wrong. Colleen could barely fathom the ridiculousness of that question. For lack of something better, she said she was cold.
Janice closed the box and jaunted up the stairs. A few minutes later, Colleen felt a blanket drape over her. Colleen had almost forgotten about Janice, and now her mind couldn't think of anything else. What kind of woman would stand by while her husband did this? Colleen felt instinctively that Janice would never join in on the torture, but she did nothing to stop it. None of it made sense.
In the days that followed, a routine set in. The box was locked over Colleen's head all day until after dinner, when Cameron would come downstairs to feed Colleen, let her use the bathroom, then torture her. Cameron likely didn't know it, but he had begun the initial stage of brainwashing Colleen, and Colleen fell back on common coping mechanisms.
According to Dr. Leach, people kept in extreme isolation for long periods of time tend to cope by praying and planning a future for after their release. And true to form, Colleen tried to stave off boredom by creating a future for herself in her mind.
She would imagine herself owning a beautiful house that she shared with a child of her own. She prayed for God to intervene and help her. She tried to be patient and keep faith that one day she would have a chance to escape.
Colleen also tried to understand Cameron Hooker. She wasn't familiar with the term sadist, but she knew Cameron enjoyed torturing her. His favorite part seemed to be after the torture, when he would climb on top of her and choke her till near death. When her eyes began to roll back, he'd finally let go. Air would rush to her lungs too quickly. It almost felt stabbing.
After a week of Cameron's brutality, Colleen decided she had to try something to improve her situation. Otherwise, she didn't think she'd last long. She had tried fighting Cameron to little success, so she decided to try compliance. And the next morning, Colleen put her new strategy to the test.
On May 26, 1977, Colleen awoke to the sound of something being built next to her. When construction was finished, Cameron took off the box around Colleen's head. Through her flimsy blindfold, she saw what he had built. A coffin.
Colleen's stomach flipped. She wondered if this time he wouldn't let go when her eyes rolled back. She wondered whether he'd done this before. Then she noticed the simple wooden coffin had a dismantled hairdryer sticking out of it. A ventilation system.
Colleen almost felt relieved. It seemed as though he wanted her to live. At least for now.
Cameron began to fill Colleen's ears with wax to further isolate her. Instead of fighting him, Colleen obliged. She let him lay her down in the coffin and stayed still as he chained her up inside, rendering her unable to move.
Colleen could feel panic rising as Cameron shut the lid, plunging her into darkness, but she calmed herself and prayed.
She would remain inside the box 23 hours a day for the next 7 months.
Over those months, her routine never changed. A blindfolded trip to the bedpan, a barely edible dinner, and a large glass of water. Then Cameron would torture her. It was also during this time that Colleen realized how very skilled at torture Cameron was. He loved to hang her by her wrists and whip her. But he seemed to know the exact moment her body started to go into shock and would take her down. He avoided cutting her skin with the whips to avoid an infection that could lead to Colleen's death.
In July of 1977, after over 2 months in captivity, Cameron decided to give Colleen a bath. While she was washing, still blindfolded, Cameron grabbed Colleen's head. He forced her underneath the water until she passed out. Colleen knew he wasn't going to kill her. This was just one more brand of torture being added to the repertoire. She tried to disengage mentally from what was happening, like she was hovering above her own body, watching it slowly drown.
Dr. Joe Magliano of Northern Illinois University calls this state of mental separation transient hypofrontality, which occurs when the frontal lobes, which are responsible for focused thinking, become less active and other parts of the brain take over. Similar to a runner's high, it's associated with feelings of calmness, a sense of being separated from time, and a floating sensation.
But despite her temporary mental escapes, Colleen was constantly terrified. One night, Cameron threatened her, saying if she wasn't quiet, he would cut out her vocal cords. He said he'd done it before.
Days later, peering into double walls of the box as she climbed out, Colleen saw something: her purse and other personal items, and a small wallet-sized photo. It was of a young woman with brown hair, who she would later identify as Marie Elizabeth Spanicky.
Colleen knew why Cameron had put the image there. She didn't know whether he had really killed this woman or not, but his message was clear. Colleen wondered what happened to this woman, whether she was dead, and if so, how Cameron had finally killed her. It would be years before she would get her answers.
Time stood still inside Colleen's coffin, but outside the box, the Hooker household was full of change. In December 1977, Janice announced that she was pregnant with her second child. Suddenly, the financially strapped Hookers needed all the extra money they could get their hands on.
Cameron Hooker had rarely spoken to Colleen, outside of barking orders, but one night in December, he handed her a large bag of walnuts and told her to crack them overnight. Colleen, knowing better than to disobey, stayed up all night cracking the walnuts inside her tiny box.
It was slow, painstaking work, given that she was blindfolded, barely able to move, and walnuts are notoriously hard to crack. But she was grateful to have something to do.
In the morning, Cameron took the cracked walnuts into town and sold them for a small fee. The next night, he came to Colleen with more nuts to crack.
Soon, Colleen was spending every night laboring for the family. Apart from cracking walnuts, she would crochet little knickknacks. Cameron would take Colleen's handiwork to a big flea market near San Jose and sell them.
It wasn't much money, but for the impoverished Hookers, it was something. And for Colleen, it was a notable change. She gradually became more than just a torture victim. It was technically slavery, but it was also a way of making herself more indispensable to the family. If nothing else, it gave them a reason to keep her alive.
In a moment, Colleen's role drastically changes within the Hooker household.
Now, back to the story.
In January of 1978, Colleen Stan's 21st birthday passed by without a celebration and without her knowledge. She'd been held captive for 8 months.
On this day, however, something different happened. Something that changed the course of her confinement to come. Cameron Hooker withdrew Colleen from the box, but instead of torturing her, he gave her a pen and paper and ordered her to practice signing her name.
For the first time since she was kidnapped, Colleen's blindfold was taken off, and she finally got a good look at her kidnapper. Cameron Hooker had a dull, round face, thin lips, and wire glasses. It was almost remarkable how normal and forgettable he looked.
Colleen's hands were weak and aching, but she knew better than to defy her captor. She practiced her signature. Then Cameron placed a document in front of Colleen. He told her to hurry. A representative from the company was upstairs waiting for her signature.
Colleen was confused. Then Cameron showed her a newspaper article that purported that around the world, women were being abducted and forced into slavery. According to Cameron, Colleen was soon to be one of them.
According to Dr. Leach, the psychological effects of extreme isolation, such as Colleen had endured, include increased susceptibility to suggestion, instability of belief, and increased compliance. Essentially, Colleen was in no place to rationalize anything Cameron was telling her.
Cameron told her that from now on, she was to refer to him as Master and Janice as Ma'am. She would be forbidden to sit or speak unless given permission, and she wasn't allowed to wear underwear. Finally, Cameron gave her a new slave name, Kay.
Colleen was so overwhelmed she couldn't begin to process what was happening. Finally, she read the document in front of her. It was a slave contract. Cameron wanted her to sign the document, giving away her freedom.
She wanted to shut down, to scream, but she knew that would only incite more torture. Heartbroken, she signed, and Cameron gladly ran the document upstairs.
Cameron had an extensive collection of hardcore fringe pornography. One of his favorite films was the 1975 French art film Story of O, an erotic drama about a woman who is subjected to sadomasochistic rituals, including torture and beatings. In the film, the woman is given the single letter name O. This is clearly where Cameron got the idea for Colleen's new name.
What's more, while thumbing through the January 1978 issue of his favorite underground S&M newspaper, Inside News, Cameron had seen a mock slave contract. While the document was meant as a prop between two consenting adults, Cameron had another use in mind. With a rented typewriter and calligraphy stencils, he reproduced the slave contract with exacting detail and presented it to Colleen, along with an accompanying article, which he passed off as real.
But Cameron needed more than just a slave contract to gain full control over Colleen. He came up with an elaborate lie, a fictitious company of slavers that would hunt Colleen down if she ever tried to run. He said they'd kill her family.
Hooker spent the following weeks, months, and even years embellishing his lie about the company to Colleen.
He told her that he'd been raised around the slave trade, and that if his father found out about Colleen, he'd be tempted to borrow Colleen for parties.
A few weeks after making her sign the slave contract, Cameron handed Colleen a laminated registration card, saying that he'd just received it from the company. The card acknowledged receipt of $1,500 for the registration of a new slave, Colleen Stan.
It was a simple deception, but it worked. Colleen spent hours in isolation churning over the registration card. In her mind, this was indisputable proof that the company was real. Cameron told her the house and phone were bugged, and if she ever tried to escape, the company would catch her and torture her to death.
In April 1978, 11 months after Colleen had been captured, the Hookers bought an acre of land near a sparsely populated trailer park in Red Bluff, California. And since the family was getting a new home, it only seemed right that Colleen would as well.
Cameron used his considerable woodworking skills to fashion a new coffin-sized box that would fit underneath his and Janice's waterbed. sound and light-proof. It was the perfect place to keep Colleen hidden. He threw a bedpan inside and locked her in.
But elsewhere in the small Hooker household, trouble was stirring. Janice, now 20 years old and pregnant, was growing resentful. Cameron still abused Janice. He would tie her up, whip her, and if she ever mouthed off, he would threaten to kill.
Janice had never liked the idea of another woman in the house, but she was so petrified of Cameron that she was willing to indulge him in the hopes that he would take out his sadistic impulses on Colleen instead of on her.
However, as Janice's torture continued, she began to realize she had misjudged Cameron's intentions. It put her in a difficult position.
As complicated as their relationship was, Janice believed that she was in love with Cameron. But with Colleen in the house, Janice couldn't be sure that Cameron loved only her. She decided to test Cameron. She suggested bringing Colleen into bed with them.
To her horror, Cameron heartily agreed. Cameron abused both women that night and raped Colleen.
Janice felt sick. She didn't think Cameron would ever have sex with another woman. She was never able to fully forgive him. And luckily for Colleen, it was the first crack in their relationship.
According to Harvard psychologist Dr. Craig Malkin, spouses in abusive relationships often suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. One symptom is dissociation, which often creates a profound detachment from reality. At times, the sufferers hardly remember being hurt by their spouse at all. Some dissociating victims may struggle to leave abusive relationships because they aren't psychologically present enough to recall the pain in its full detail.
Janice mentally distanced herself from the pain and torment Cameron inflicted and chose not to remember the abuse. She instead focused on raising her children. But if Janice hoped for Cameron to lose interest in Colleen, she was wildly mistaken. Around this time, Cameron began mulling over a plan to bring Colleen deeper into the family fold.
As time wore on, Colleen was given more privileges in the household and more time out of the box each day. Investigators would later call her fourth year of captivity, 1980, Colleen's year out. Cameron was so confident in his control over Colleen that he allowed her to go for jogs around the block.
Colleen was still terrified of the company, which she believed was watching her every move. When neighbors stood on their porches and waved at her, she wondered if they might be with the company. She never dared run away.
Colleen built up the courage to eventually ask her captors for a Bible. To her surprise, Cameron gave her one. Colleen had been praying since the beginning of her captivity and now began reading the Bible every day, often while she babysat the Hooker's two young daughters, 4-year-old Charity and 2-year-old Amber.
As evil as Cameron Hooker was, his daughters never suspected anything was amiss in the house. He never abused them or revealed his sadistic streak. To the children, Colleen was nothing more than a friendly babysitter.
One night in 1980, Cameron told Colleen that she was to go out dancing with Janice. Confused, Colleen went along with Janice to a bar. It became clear that Janice had grown jealous of Cameron and Colleen's relationship and had demanded sexual freedoms of her own. At the bar, Janice and Colleen met two men, and Janice insisted that Colleen join her as she went home with one of them.
Colleen stood outside the bedroom as Janice began an affair with one of the men from the bar. Surprisingly, when Janice later told Cameron about the affair, he didn't seem to care. Janice seemed heartbroken, but she ended the affair and returned to Cameron, if begrudgingly.
This became something like a routine. Janice would build up the courage to leave Cameron, only to return the next day with her tail between her legs. She was terrified of him, But her bigger fear was that no one else would love her. Remember, Cameron was the only person to ever tell Janice she was important to him. Not even her own parents had shown her affection. Her life was a waking nightmare, but it was one that she had worked hard to build.
For her part, Colleen continued to help supplement Cameron's income. During her year out in 1980, she was made to panhandle on the street, giving all her collections to Cameron.
Gradually, over the course of 1980, Colleen was also allowed to sleep in the bathroom instead of her box. During the day, when the children were taking a nap, Colleen had the trailer to herself. The door was open, but fear of the company kept her from escaping.
And part of gaining these increased freedoms was learning to tell Cameron what he wanted to hear.
In May of 1980, on the third anniversary of her kidnapping, she wrote Cameron a card which said, quote, "Sometimes I feel that being your slave has made me more of a woman. I love you so much for it. I only wish that my dreams could be fulfilled with you, because I feel a strong love and need to be with you. I'll always serve you with a singleness of heart."
Colleen's note worked. Cameron was noticeably less savage to her in the following months. He even granted her a previously unthought-of privilege. One day, while Colleen was brought along with the family to shop in Chico, California, Cameron allowed Colleen to phone her parents.
Colleen's younger sister answered the phone. Her sister asked, "Who's this?"
Colleen answered with dead silence. She had no idea what to say.
Colleen's sister asked again, and finally, worried she might hang up, Colleen whispered, "It's your sister."
Colleen asked how her family had been and was quickly filled in on some details. But when asked where she'd been, Colleen went silent. Cameron Hooker stood right next to her, ready to hang up at her slightest misstep. The phone call was short, but for Colleen, it was a major triumph.
Cameron continued to allow Colleen to call her family. One day in late summer of 1980, Colleen was even allowed to call her dad twice in one day. She never gave details on where she was. She told them she was babysitting for a family. Colleen was happy just to hear her family's voices, even though it ached every time she hung up the phone.
But Cameron never did anything for the sake of kindness. Part of her wondered why she was being allowed to call home. Did he see it as some kind of reward, or perhaps a different kind of torture? She also knew things could change quickly. One wrong move would put her back in the box.
It might seem odd that Colleen's family seemed so unconcerned, but in actuality, there was a method to the way they spoke to her over the phone. Unbeknownst to Colleen, when she first went missing, her roommate had been the first to file a missing persons report with the Eugene Police Department, but no tips were ever reported, and police made no progress on her case.
A month after her kidnapping, Colleen failed to write a Father's Day card, a tradition she never missed. That's when her father knew she was truly in trouble. Colleen's father contacted his ex-wife, whom he hadn't had much contact with since Colleen was a child, and the two of them drove up and down the coast, talking with various police departments in the towns Colleen may have been hitchhiking through.
But as is so often the case with missing hitchhikers, there was no sign of Colleen. She had simply vanished.
Colleen's family never gave up hope that she was out there somewhere. So when she started calling them throughout the summer of 1980, they tried not to press her with questions. They were afraid of scaring her away forever. And likewise, Colleen was scared of losing them.
Meanwhile, the better Cameron treated Colleen, the worse he seemed to treat Janice. He periodically beat his wife until she wept. One day, while Colleen was playing with the toddlers outside the trailer, they could hear Janice being beaten inside. 4-year-old Charity asked Colleen, Why is Mommy crying?
Colleen told the little girls she didn't hear anything. She took their hands and led them to play on the other side of the house.
Janice took out her frustrations by exerting power over Colleen. Janice complained to Cameron about Colleen's cooking and cleaning, and even made up stories to get Colleen whipped. Colleen knew better than to speak up, that part of Janice's frustration was that the girls had started occasionally calling Colleen Mommy.
In the fall of 1980, Cameron started construction on a large hole in the backyard, where he planned to create an intricate sex dungeon. He shared a secret with Colleen, that his dream was to kidnap 4 more sex slaves and build a cabin in the backyard for Colleen to be his slave wife. Her job would be to train the new slave girls. Colleen was horrified.
Over time, Colleen proved herself loyal to Cameron, and in February 1981, she was allowed to sleep in the family's living room. Janice still directed her anger towards Colleen, but Cameron had made a big decision about Colleen's future.
One night, Cameron told Colleen to kneel before him. He told her that the company had decided to allow her to visit her family in Riverside. He said it was unprecedented, that no slave had ever visited family before. He'd paid a $30,000 fee to cover the company's extra security around her parents' house and the extra wiretaps. Finally, he told Colleen that if there were any problems, the company would swarm the house and kill her family.
Colleen was ecstatic. She promised she wouldn't tell her family a thing. But Cameron demanded a final test before Colleen would be allowed to visit her family. He got out his shotgun and blindfolded Colleen. Cameron told Colleen to put her lips around the barrel of the shotgun, then pull the trigger.
Colleen had no way of knowing whether the gun was loaded, but if she wasn't allowed to see her family, she felt as good as dead anyway. She closed her eyes, thought of home, and pulled the trigger.
Next week, we'll cover the unlikely way Colleen's ordeal finally comes to an end.
Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We'll be back next Thursday with part 2.
You can find more episodes of Hostage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
Well, several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Andy Waits, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Libeskin. Additional production assistance by Maggie Edmeyer and Carly Madden. This episode of Hostage is written by Scott Hipp and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.